Welcome to Guerrilla Radio. Well, unprecedented seems too trite a term to describe Washington's new normal. Last week, perched atop the steps of the Environmental Protection Agency and flanked by a phalanx of coal workers, President Trump signed the death warrant of Obama's Clean Power Plan. In an apparent continuation of his unheard-of grudge match with the former president, Trump claimed to be taking historic steps to cancel job-killing regulations. But Trump's executive order is exactly more than petty spite or even populist grandstanding. It's actually just one part of a larger plan determined to annihilate all Obama administration efforts to curb carbon emissions. Meanwhile, reports from media-fringed outfits like the World Meteorological Organization warn, after consecutive years of highest-ever mean average temperatures and record-low Arctic ice levels, planet Earth has entered truly uncharted territory. Dar Jamal is a journalist and author whose books, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, and Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq, chronicle his intrepid dispatches from America's war zones, where he spent more than a year in Iraq, as well as filing reports from Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Turkey over a 10-year span. The Martha Gellhorn Investigative Journalism Awardee currently serves as staff reporter at truthout.org, where his monthly column, Climate Disruption Dispatches, accompanies his regular articles. Dar's third book, The Mass Destruction of Iraq, Why It Is Happening and Who Is Responsible, is co-authored with Truthout editor William Rivers Pitt, and his latest is the forthcoming The End of Ice. Dar Jamal in the first half, and while climate disruption, terrorism, war, and rumors of it compete for space in our nightmares, the preeminent global horror is being overlooked. Sleepwalking to Armageddon is pioneering anti-nuclear activist Helen Caldicott's latest attempt to bring some semblance of sanity to the political stage. In the book, she assembles contributions from the world's leading nuclear scientists and thought leaders to assess the political and scientific dimensions of the threat of nuclear war today. Dr. Helen Caldicott on rousing a somnambulant polity in the second half. And Victoria, CFUV radio broadcaster Janine Bancroft will be here at the bottom of the hour in a rare in-studio appearance to bring us up to speed with a Left Coast events update of some of the good things planned in the coming week around here and beyond too. But first, Dar Jamal and the Trump denialists going into overdrive as climate change accelerates 170 times faster than predicted. Stick around. Welcome back to the program, Dar.
Thanks, Chris. Good to be back.
Oh, sorry. I thought I might have put you to sleep there. Well, it's always great to have you. Now, listen, Dar, you know, how does Trump's old King Cole worldview here dovetail with the impending end of ice, as you describe in your articles at Truth Out?
Well, if we're going for a replication in reality of a really bad sci-fi dystopian scenario, it dovetails quite perfectly. It's really literally the worst possible administration that could have occurred here in the United States amidst the backdrop of catastrophic and now what some scientific reports that I did an article on recently are even starting to describe as apocalyptic levels of climate change that could well already be upon us. And so it's really, truly a worst-case scenario.
Well, tell me a little bit, Dar. It's been a while since we talked last, like 6 months or so, and then we were talking about military war games off the coast here in the Pacific Northwest. It seems that the new Trump administration, though teasingly saying that they were going to be non-interventionists abroad, have upped the military ante. What about the activity of the military and its effect as a climate disruptor?
Well, the U.S. military is the single largest CO2 emitter on the planet, for starters, so that's the key factor. And then on top of that, we have the amount of materials that, for example, I've been covering the Navy real heavily, which is what you alluded to last time we spoke, and I actually just got back from Alaska working on a big story that we're going to publish this coming Monday about naval exercises happening every other year up in the Gulf of Alaska, where they're permitted to dump what they refer to as expended materials, 352,000 pounds of them that they're permitted to dump into the Gulf of Alaska. Expended materials meaning bombs, missiles, torpedoes, etc., and then the fuels of torpedoes, for example, that have nice things like cyanide in them and other types of extremely toxic materials. And these exercises plan to take place starting on May 1st this time around, which just so happens to be almost directly coinciding with the opening of commercial fishing season up there. So to date, we've got 9 different fishing communities across Alaska, from things like Seward and Valdez and Cordova to even smaller communities, and possibly Kodiak coming on board tomorrow as well, having passed city resolutions opposing the timing and location of the Navy's war games. But it's all for naught. The Navy keeps steaming forward, doing what they're doing, along with other branches of the military, but as they continue to broaden the scope of their domestic military exercises and expansionism, are, of course, simultaneously broadening the scope of the amount of toxins that they're releasing into the environment, in addition to the massive amounts of CO2 emissions.
Well, this idea, Dar, I mean, I don't know if you're from Alaska and have a special interest in what goes on up there, but with the melting north, is this a possibility then that the Navy and others will be moving up into the Arctic Ocean to do their tests and perhaps start dumping stuff over the side there?
I think it's only a matter of time. I mean, it really is the race for what's left at this point. And while they've been doing, they call them Northern Edge, the name of these exercises that I was just speaking of, they've been doing these for decades, but we're definitely seeing a ramping up of them. And in fact, the one this year may not be as big as some in the past, but they're basically gearing up already for Northern Edge 2019, which is expected to be the biggest ever on record. And I think that this, in addition to the amount of increasing funding and more ships and more personnel and all of this across the board in the military, as we're seeing with the Trump administration, coupled with a melting of the Arctic and sort of this geopolitical chess game of countries that have a stake in the Arctic and are positioning themselves to access the oil that's up there and other types of minerals and other natural resources, that certainly that's a huge factor in this ramping up of the military in the far north in the United States.
Well, the Obama administration, or should I say even the Obama administration, they green-lighted exploration in the Arctic, oil exploration up there. But if I remember rightly, Shell backed away from it. They got the okay to do it, but it proved so problematic to them, and the price of low, I suppose, or the price of oil being low, they just decided to chuck it in. Is there interest that you're aware that other oil companies or Shell will reconsider and move back up into the north to start exploration for oil up there again?
It appears as though right now that and you just hit on it. One was the danger in drilling when there's still so much sea ice, and the longer they wait, the less sea ice there's going to be. We could have what scientists refer to as blue ocean event in the summer up there, where we're going to start seeing periods beginning at the end of the summer where we have no summer sea ice, which would be the first time in recorded history, in human history, that this has ever happened. And of course, a extremely troublesome new phenomena happening to the planet that's going to have massive and immediate implications on global climate patterns. But once that starts happening, then it starts making drilling for oil in the far north start to become a lot more feasible. And so it does appear as though a lot of these major oil companies, Shell included, are just biding their time for that to happen, coupled with, as you also mentioned, the price of oil. Right now it's trading at about $49-ish a barrel, give or take a couple of bucks depending on the day and the week. And until that goes back up, which I think it will eventually, certainly in the long run, but in the short to even midterm, it's not really expected to. And it's not, bottom line is they can't make money, the amount of resources needed and money needed to drill offshore until oil spikes back up. It's just not going to be real feasible for them. But again, I think that just means they're biding their time. It's not if, but when.
Well, most of us, when we think of the oil industry and burning carbon-based fuels, we think about CO2, and we've heard a lot about CO2. But in the north, there's something a little more threatening even, and many people know about methane. But as the sea ice melts and the permafrost melts, we're looking at an even greater threat than CO2, aren't we?
We are, very much so. In fact, we published a recent article of mine that I did on a study that kind of came out but stayed under most folks' radars. It was a study published in a prestigious peer-reviewed journal called Paleo World just this past December. And the study said, and I'll just read you a couple of sentences from the abstract. It says, global warming triggered by the massive release of CO2 may be catastrophic, but the release of methane from hydrate may be apocalyptic. And those are very, very strong words, but it's because the study goes into the fact that if we look back at the Permian mass extinction event, the single largest mass extinction event the Earth has ever experienced, which happened 250 million years ago, it wiped out between 90 and 95% of all life on Earth. And the key player in that mass extinction event was methane hydrate. And what's really problematic is that the events leading up to that mass extinction, there was basically a giant ongoing volcanic release of CO2 into the atmosphere over tens of thousands of years that eventually warmed the atmosphere enough that the Arctic started melting, the permafrost and the subsea ice to start to release methane hydrates. And that is then what really kicked the atmospheric warming up into overdrive, because methane is 100 times more potent greenhouse gas than CO2 is over the short term. And so that was the key ingredient in that mass extinction. Now, we're basically creating the same conditions. We've pumped such an enormous amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. We're already seeing warming. We've warmed the planet 1°C. That's been enough to start causing widespread melting in the Arctic of permafrost and even some of the subsea methane. We're already seeing some of these releases happen. So the question is that going to continue? How fast will that develop? And then there will be methane bursts, which we've also been warned about, where massive amounts of this could be released in very, very short periods of time. And so that's, the worrisome thing to me is it does appear as though the conditions are set. It's just a matter of how much faster does this start to get released, and then of course, keeping our eye on the effects of that. So that is obviously a very, very big factor. And why I've written about the methane issue in the Arctic a lot and continue to write about it, and this is all just underscored by the fact that the Arctic, once again, is just seeing possibly one of the warmest in its entire history. Through different parts of the winter, we saw temperature deviations as much as between 30 and 50 degrees above normal in certain parts of the Arctic. Mm-hmm. And we all know that the Arctic's warming 2 to 3 times faster than the rest of the planet. And so, with those temperature issues, we hear IPCC warnings that, by 2100, the global temperature could increase by 5 to 6 degrees C, worst-case scenario. Well, they're already seeing more than that in parts of the Arctic in certain parts of the year. So if we want to get an idea of what the planet is going to be experiencing in the future, well, the future is happening right now up in the Arctic.
And the IPCC is the International Panel on Climate Change, is that right?
Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, right. They're really the leading authority that everyone cites on, their assessments to come out every 7 years about the state of the planet and all of their modeling and predictions about what's going to happen as far as worst case scenarios of sea level rise, temperature increase, etc. But the problem is their modeling is consistently not keeping up with how fast things are actually happening in reality.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Gorilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dar Jamal. Dar is the Martha Gellhorn Awardee for Investigative Journalism. His books, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, and Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq, are intrepid examinations of America at War. He did this from the inside, and as the book says, unembedded. His third book, The Mass Destruction of Iraq, Why It Is Happening and Who Is Responsible, is co-authored authored with Truth Out editor William Rivers Pitt, where Dar writes now at truthout.org. His forthcoming book is The End of ICE. And The End of ICE, I mean, are we seeing, Dar, with the... is the release of methane now the reason that one of your recent articles at Truth Out is, as Trump's denialists get to work, the climate is changing 170 times faster. Is that 170-time increase, is that indicative of methane being released now, or is that just, you know, based on the carbon emissions that we're putting out as a more regular, if I can use that term, way?
That's based primarily on CO2, because so far, most studies aren't taking methane into account, even though its prevalence in the atmosphere is increasing dramatically. But no, that paper that you just cited that statistic from is called the Anthropocene Equation, and it talks about climate disruption changing the climate 170 times faster than it would if only natural forces were affecting it. And so one of the authors of that study said, quote, "The human magnitude of climate change looks more like a meteorite strike than a gradual change." And again, I think it's important for people to remember that when we talk about these changes, we're talking, at least I am, talking about it on a geologic time scale. And so, for example, you know, we were talking about the Permian mass extinction event. Well, that's an event that took place over 80-something thousand years. We are causing these changes in a matter of a couple of hundred years. I mean, we can argue about when exactly the Industrial Revolution began. Did it start when agriculture began? But, I mean, for the sake of argument, if we just talk about machines that started emitting CO2 into the atmosphere, let's just say roughly 250 years ago, so we're basically creating similar conditions to the Permian mass extinction, except instead of over 80,000 years, we're looking at 250-ish years. So on a geologic time scale, this is an eye blink. This is lightning fast, the pace at which we're literally changing the composition of the atmosphere and the chemistry of the ocean.
Well, the denialists that you mentioned in the top of that article, too, as Trump denialists, but certainly Trump's supporters aren't the only ones that can't really come to grips with the human contribution to all of this. I mean, it's hard to imagine that we little humans can have this great an effect on this huge planet. Is there a way, Dar, that we little humans can actually reverse this trend?
There's really not. I mean, I think the only reasonable reaction at this point, if global governments were to react accordingly to the crisis that we are in, all CO2 emissions would be stopped on a dime tomorrow. And we would be finding ways to sequester as much carbon CO2 back out of the atmosphere as quickly as possible. So no more chopping down trees, planting forests as quickly as possible, finding other ways to mitigate and draw CO2 out of the atmosphere. But instead of that, you know, we actually are continuing to emit at extremely high levels and not really change our behavior. And there is no current technology that exists that is capable of sequestering the amount of carbon that would be required to sequester out of the atmosphere at the pace that it would have to happen and at the scale that it would have to happen to make a real difference. Because, you know, when we emit carbon, it takes between 10 and 40 years for its full impacts across global climate to actually even be shown. So even if we stopped everything on a dime, we've still got 10 to 40 years of waiting to see the effects of everything that we've already injected up into the atmosphere. So that's another part of the equation that doesn't get talked about very much. Not even talk about that the vast amount of the heat that we've generated on the planet has been absorbed into the oceans. In fact, 90% of it. So a lot of scientists actually believe at some point that heat has to come back out of the oceans. So do the oceans then basically factor in as another runaway feedback loop when they start releasing that heat back out of the ocean? So there's numerous parts of the equation, and I just glossed over a few right now that people aren't really taking into account, and I think that underscore the fact that there is no techno fix to this. switching over to renewables, while certainly morally obligatory and important and helpful, you know, is really a drop in the bucket compared to the fact that we've already emitted so much CO2 and methane into the atmosphere that, you know, nothing short of a dramatic, massive scale, planetary scale technology that could immediately suck all of that back out of the atmosphere and sequester it safely somewhere would really have much impact in real mitigation of the crisis that we're in.
Well, you mentioned the fast moving effect of these methane creating hydrates. Is it can we take those hydrates? I know that there's been research on using the hydrates as a fuel source. I mean, can we repurpose Exxon and Shell and the rest of them to mine methates and get them out of the loop, either using them as fuel or sequestering them somewhere where they won't disrupt climate?
That is on the radar. There is talk of that. But again, you're talking about scale. There's a problem with scale where how do you contain methane that's being emitted over areas of tens of thousands of square miles across the Arctic region of the entire planet, and then not even talking about how do you get at methane that's trapped in sea ice in the shallow seabed of the Arctic Ocean. So certainly that's discussed. There's already research teams trying to figure out how to do that, but again, there's not an answer for the scale at which it would have to happen to really have a real impact on the total emissions that are already starting to be released up into the atmosphere.
Well, it seems to me we've got a race against time. I'm wondering, Dar, should I just, you know, sort of forget about my registered retirement savings plans and cash them in today and just, you know, not think about the future so much?
Well, I feel like, you know, that's a really good question, and it's a tough one to answer because it basically brings up literally an existential crisis that we as a species are in. If we look squarely at the facts about how far along we really are with human-caused climate disruption, the circumstances we've already set in motion and that are certain to worsen with each passing day. And I think each one of us needs to look very closely at our lives and think, what else can I do? What am I morally obliged to do to try to assist the planet during this time? And then look real squarely at how am I living my life, and am I really living it the way I want to be living it? Am I passing time with people I want to be passing time with? And just get very honest about how I'm going to deal with this new world that we're living in, because, you know, we're certainly, you know, the coming years, and not even talking about a decade out, we're looking at planetary changes that are going to be something out of sci-fi movies and sci-fi novels, with between rising sea levels, collapsing governments, political instability, all of these things happening simultaneously. And so it really puts us in a position where, look, we have to accept that we live in a new world now. This is not the world that I'm middle-aged now, but it's not the world that I grew up in, where I thought the future was kind of indefinite and I'm going to be able to make long-range plans and things are stable and I can bank on that. This is a changing, dynamic situation, and I think we all need to take that into account.
Well, and not to mention the depression of watching one species after another get tipped over the edge and disappear in front of our eyes.
That's true, and it underscores, you know, as hard as this information is to take in, I think ideally it would basically cause us to open our hearts up more and really pay attention to what's really, really important and start thinking about things differently, not be in this kind of industrial corporate mindset of everything's about making money and making plans for the future and retirement and such, but what am I doing today? Is what I'm doing today really, really important to me? What are some things I can do to really try to help the planet? And it's not in these activities, at least me personally, I can't be focused on the results, because if I look at the big picture, it is completely overwhelming. Mm-hmm. But what can I do to kind of keep my side of the street clean, and what can I do to minimize my carbon footprint? How much more of my own food can I grow? And basically just live simply and very present moment and still doing the things that I feel like we are all morally obliged to do to try to help, despite the fact that things do look extremely bleak, but that does not exempt us from behaving morally and with dignity.
Well, you're doing a lot more than most of us, Dar. It's Dar Jamal. You can find his writings at truthout.org or Dar Jamal, DarJamal.net. Thanks a lot, Dar, for coming on again, eh?
Thanks a lot, Chris. I always appreciate being on your program.
Well, it's mutual, I assure you. Till the next time. Well, now I'm going to take a brief break, and when I come back, hopefully, Janine will be here in studio with me to bring us up to speed with some of the local things going on for the coming week. So do stick around for that. And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Joining me now, as oftentimes she does, is CFUV radio broadcaster Janine Bancroft. But today, Janine, you're right here with me instead of being on the phone. How's it going?
Or instead of being with my head in the white bucket at
home.
Still
sick.
Oh my God. Well, I haven't puked for several days, but I swear, I think there's it's underreported. There's an article I found from February about a norovirus in one of the hospitals, and I was working in a different hospital last week, and I came home with this thing, and I don't know, and some of my coworkers are out with it, so I don't know what it is, but it's big, and it's nasty, and it's taking over the world.
Well, I've not been 100% myself, and people that I've been interacting with have been saying, yeah, there's definitely something going around in Victoria right now.
Yeah, so be careful out there. Apparently it can travel by air too, so that's always encouraging. Now, if we're all going to die anyways, right? So there are some really great parties this week.
Oh, good.
Yeah, the Pull Together folk are inviting people in Victoria to a Pull Together dance party Friday at Fairfield United, and this is for raising money to support the First Nations heading to court trying to stop the Kinder Morgan pipeline. So we might as well dance and have fun as the world burns. $10 to $30, sliding scale. Of course, you can give more if you want. And if money is an obstacle, contact them. They want people to come and have fun. But also, it's nice if we can support folks. They've got Jasmine Love, blending world beat, electronic and organic sounds, and then Anchor Hill with an eclectic blend of classically influenced electronica and dance music. So this is in the hall directly east of Fairfield United Church. It's wheelchair accessible. They have gender-inclusive washrooms. It sounds lots of fun. They want people to go by bike or public transit, of course, if they can. And Friday at 8 in Victoria. Saturday at the liquor store at Fort and Fal Bay, the Kaya people, the Canadians Against Israeli Apartheid, are going to be outside the liquor store there, Fort and Fal Bay, to try to educate shoppers and encourage the boycott of Israeli wine. So if anybody wants to drop by and support that, 12:30 to 2 on Saturday. And all they say that all the Israeli wines that they have discovered are produced on the occupied lands of the Palestinian people. Maud Barlow's in town on the weekend, Chris.
Oh, really? Yeah.
She's so great. She's got a new book. I'm sure it's all full of great, wonderful, happy things about water. It's called Boiling Point, Government Neglect, Corporate Abuse, and Canada's Water Crisis. So she says, you know, if you think that we have unlimited supplies of water and that we've taken care of the water and that we still have lots of time, you know, yeah. So they're asking people to register ahead of time. She's going to be at the UVic on Saturday at 2 till 4. It's free, but it is in a room with limited seating at A240 at the Human and Social Development Building. You could go to the Canadians.ca website to find out more about that, Canadians.org.
Yeah.
Right. And she's also going to be in Comox April 6th, is that tomorrow, Nanaimo on Friday, Victoria Saturday, Williams Lake on the 10th, and then Kamloops on the 11th. She's not going to Vancouver.
Oh.
It's too interesting.
Too smoggy, or maybe the water's not good enough.
I don't know. Interesting, right? She's awesome, and I hope people go.
She is terrific, and she knows more about water, especially from a Canadian perspective, I think, than just about anybody. I mean, she's written book after book and studied this up, down, and sideways.
And she'll have her book, and she'll be signing them. So on Saturday in Tofino, there's a peaceful direct action training for people who are thinking about protesting the proposed Kinder Morgan pipeline. It's a short, fun workshop introducing people to the concepts of peaceful direct action. And it's good to have, you know, in your back pocket, even if you're not intending to get arrested. Who knows what's going to go down? There's a donation suggestion of $25 to $50 or pay what you can, and they're providing tea and coffee, and you can go to the ClackwhatAction.org website and find out more about that. In Vancouver on Saturday, they're having an info and trivia night for information about the Che Guevara Volunteer Brigade. And I've heard great things about the Che Brigade. This is a nice way to go to Cuba. For 2 weeks, you go volunteer working with cultural, social, economic, and political situations. That's what they educate you about while you're there. But you might be like painting a school or, you know, building something or that sort of thing. So anyways, for information about that, it's Saturday at 7 at Joe's Cafe, 1150 Commercial Drive in Vancouver. And then here's another one of those parties, Pints Not Pipelines in Vancouver.
That sounds like fun.
And that is at 1218 Cartwright Street in Vancouver. And that beer, tacos, and human rights, they say.
Oh, so, three of my favorite things.
There you go, right? It's Pull Together, again, a fundraiser for First Nations lawsuits against a Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain tar sands, pull-together.ca. And Cartwright is on Granville Island, so that's a really fun place to have a party, too. Monday, there's a rally in Vancouver to stop sightseeing Kinder Morgan. It's the last night before the writ drops, and they're asking people to go to the Vancouver Convention Center at 5 till 7 and just gathering to let Christy Clark and her cronies know that we are against the sightsee and the Kinder Morgan pipeline and whatever else, you know.
The grizzly hunt.
The list goes on, the housing, the poverty, all the rest of it. Wednesday next, there's a sustainable forestry rally at noon till 1 at the legislature in Victoria, and this is organized by the Ancient Forests Alliance and the Wilderness Committee, and there's going to be forestry workers, environmentalists, unions, politicians, diverse community members for a march and a rally, and there's a list of things that have happened to the forest since the BC Liberals came to power. There's going to be speakers. You know, they're logging in East Creek.
Yeah, I'm going to do an interview about that.
Oh,
it's
gosh.
Funny that you always come up with the stuff that I'm booked down the road, but I'm working on something for that.
Good for you. Yeah, it's just heartbreaking, these beautiful ancient forests.
It's not new. Lee, our friend there, has written about that for years and years, but the Sierra Club is taking up the cudgel right now.
And others, yeah. So next Wednesday at noon at the legislature, and that's all I got for this week.
Well, that's great, Janine. Thanks a lot. Your program is The Winds of Change. You share space with Mehdi Najjari's Hidden News, 11 a.m. Thursdays. You're on tomorrow, right?
I'm here tomorrow.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for coming in today, Janine, and bringing us up to speed, and we'll talk to you the next time, eh?
You bet. Thanks, Chris.
All right, then. Bye-bye. Now, I'm going to take a brief break and see if I can scare up Helen Caldicott. She's in North America right now, so Australian, of course. And we'll talk a little bit. If you didn't think Dar was scary enough, just wait till you get a load of this. Do stick around. Canada's own Jesse Cook. Isn't that great? That's Baghdad. Well, you know, while climate disruption, as Dara was mentioning, and terrorism, war, and rumors of it compete for space in our nightmares, the preeminent global horror is being overlooked. Sleepwalking to Armageddon is pioneering anti-nuclear activist Helen Caldicott's latest attempt to bring some semblance of sanity to the political stage. Good luck with that, Helen. In the book, she assembles contributions from the world's leading nuclear scientists and thought leaders to, quote, assess the political and scientific dimensions of the threat of nuclear war today. Dr. Helen Caldicott is a physician, author, and lecturer who has for more than 30 years studied, written, and campaigned against the proliferation of nuclear weapons and their derivatives, delivering impassioned speeches and making imprecations to both politicians and power brokers alike, those overseeing the precarious atomic tinderbox. Welcome back to the program, Helen.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Well, it's nice to have you back on this side of the Pacific. What is it they say, Helen, if you live long enough, everything comes back in fashion? Over here in Canada, Russia baiting is de rigueur, at least on the state and corporate media channel. Are we seeing, do you think, Helen, the awakenings of another mutually assured destruction, nuclear superpowered armed standoff?
Well, many people who are in the know say that we're actually closer to nuclear war now than we were at the height of the Cold War with Reagan. And I would support that. We've got a president, I can't believe he is president, who is impetuous and narcissistic, but he really is very, very ignorant. He is the only one in America who has the authority to press the button. And a man follows him around all the time with a suitcase called the football, armed with the nuclear codes. He would have 3 minutes to decide whether or not to press the button. 3 minutes. Meanwhile, you're right. There's this crazy stuff about Russia. I mean, there's no real evidence from the intelligence agencies that Russia did interfere in the election. And if they did, they only got Hillary's emails, which, you know, should have been public anyway. America's been interfering in everyone else's elections forever, including my own in Australia, uh-huh, where the CIA deposed the best Prime Minister we ever had, Gough Whitlam, who was about to announce the CIA operatives at Pine Gap the next day in Parliament. Pine Gap is the base in Australia which orchestrates a nuclear war and all the killing in the Middle East and the like and the like. So it's a very scary situation, and the media seems to have lost its mind. I don't know what they're up to, but, you know, you mention Putin and everyone says, oh, that man. Well, he kills a few of his journalists. He killed 250,000 people in Chechnya. But look, however bad that man is, we mustn't blow up the planet. We mustn't destroy evolution. I mean, God's sake, people are so primitive in the way they think.
Well, as you said, none of these allegations have been proven, and it all seems like it's just being a stick to beat up Trump for usurping Hillary Clinton, and that's all well and good. But today, the United Nations Security Council is in an emergency meeting because of this gas attack that occurred on Tuesday in Syria. It sounds very much like other, what some have called false flag attacks, but certainly not completely and documented that, you know, without leaving any trace of doubt. But America's UN ambassador was intimating today, saying that if the UN Security Council didn't do what America said, they were going to go ahead unilaterally. And this ties directly in with the Russians and maybe a hot war in Syria with the Russians.
Well, I have not seen evidence yet that Assad actually did it. I don't know who did it. Have you seen any evidence who did it?
Well, I know what's being said, and this is very similar. This hasn't been proven, and this is really important.
I mean, immediately it was in the New York Times, Assad drops chemical weapons. But, you know, like last time, where Obama was going to go to war about it,
right?
Kerry worked with the Russians, and it was found out that it wasn't Assad at all. It was the, I don't know, Al-Qaeda or whoever they call themselves now, so-called terrorists. And that stopped America unilaterally acting, and Russia helped to alleviate that. So I'm skeptical until it's proven who did it. Of course, it's a wicked, dreadful, terrible thing. But once again, we're facing the Russians in Syria. Planes are buzzing each other, Russian and American planes. And it could easily, one mistake or misunderstanding or whatever, could lead to a nuclear war. I don't know if people know, but America and Russia's weapons are on hair trigger alert, meaning they can be launched by within minutes of each other. And a nuclear war bilaterally would take about 1 hour to complete. There are 12 hydrogen bombs at least targeted on New York, and the same with, you know, most major cities in Canada and America and the like. I don't think people... There seems to be a lack of understanding of the present situation that the scientists have set up in which we live. They've wired the world up like a ticking time bomb, ready to explode any minute. And it's not being discussed.
Well, even outside of the election, the alleged election tampering and what's going on in Syria, NATO through, and it's not just Republican administrations, but throughout Obama's too, has been steadily moving eastward and surrounding Russia and committing all kinds of little acts of incitement, Ukraine being one, talking about overthrowing governments. It seems that NATO is, and the United States, its unspoken leader, are determined to push Russia into a corner where I don't know that there's anything they can do but fight or just surrender
entirely.
Well, it's
been very, very provocative. And if I were Putin, I'd be somewhat paranoid. And we know in medicine that you don't threaten a paranoid patient because they're likely to do something very dangerous and hurt you or themselves or whatever. It goes against all sort of normal psychological reaction that they should be doing this. Now, NATO is America, I know, and Canada just joins America, but NATO is America. After the Cold War ended, it was very, very bad because there was peace. And the military-industrial complex were pretty upset there was no war because that's how they survived, with having wars and stealing Americans' money to the tune of $1 trillion a year. So Norman Augustine, who was the president of Lockheed Martin, set off on a campaign to talk to all the little newly liberated Eastern European countries to say, would you like to be a democracy? Even though America had promised Gorbachev that they would not enlarge NATO. Now, to join NATO, you have to pay about $2 billion and buy yourselves lots of weapons. He was able to convince Hungary and Lithuania and Latvia and all the rest to join NATO, and it's got nothing to do with democracy. So they had to buy all these weapons, and they've enlarged NATO right up to the border of Russia. It's like saying, well, Canada is now part of the Warsaw Pact, and we're right adjacent to the American border. What would the Americans do? Well, they'd probably blow up the earth like they nearly did with the Cuban Missile Crisis. People do not seem to understand the gravity of the situation and the psychology that needs to be applied so that we'll survive. And I think Putin, under these circumstances, is being remarkably reasonable if you listen to his press conferences. And, of course, we all know that the situation in the Ukraine was actually a coup orchestrated by the State Department in America.
Yeah, but you wouldn't know that in Canada to listen to our state broadcaster.
Well, what's happened to your Canadian broadcasting system?
Well, it's been taken over. I mean, it's a propagandist. When you say that Canada moves with America, well, you know, the CBC is the government's mouthpiece, and they reflect what the government thinks. It's a sad reality.
Well, what is Trudeau doing? See, I met with Pierre Trudeau. Mm. And had lunch with him to talk to him about testing cruise missiles in Canada. And for a long time he said, you know, we're going to continue doing it. And I said, but most people in Canada don't support that. Is this a democracy? He said, if we have a real democracy, everyone in Canada would have guns. I thought that was a funny perspective. Anyway, after a long time of discussing the issue of nuclear war, I turned to him and I said, what about your children? And his face turned white because he adored those boys. And I convinced him to do the Five Continent, Six Nation Peace Initiative, and he set off around the world to try and develop peace around the world. Now, I don't know what is happening with his son, who is very beautiful and says good things in many areas, but he's apparently towing the American line. And I would very much like to meet with him for lunch, talk to him about his wonderful father and his legacy, and see if he has the courage to stand up to the very powerful neighbor to the south of Canada and assert Canadian, you know, independent authority like Lester Pearson and Pierre Trudeau and the like.
Well, Helen, I'd be very interested to hear what happens at that meeting, but I suspect that all you would get would be a selfie.
Oh, no. Well, I mean, he's a very smart fellow, and knowing that I knew his father really quite well, you know, and he obviously adored his father, I may have an entree, I don't know, but I'd love to try.
Well, when you talk about leadership, you know, I mean, it's one thing to poo-poo Trump, and he was preceded by, you know, Reagan and Bush Jr., which I couldn't believe got elected either. But you met Ronald Reagan, and you had a chance to sit down and talk to him too, right?
Yes, I spent an hour and a quarter with him in the White House alone. I had longer time alone with him than anyone else during his presidency. His daughter was there, Patty, but she said nothing. And I started off by saying, you probably don't know who I am, do you? He said, yes, you're an Australian. You read On the Beach when you're a young girl and you're scared of nuclear war. And I said, yes, that's right. And he said, well, I too am scared of nuclear war, but our ways to prevent it, I believe in building more bombs. So we're off to a great start. I'd just written my book, Missile Envy, so I was just packed with facts and figures. And everything he said was inaccurate. So I would stop him and correct him. And you know, when he got a bit nervous, he'd get flushed. And so he'd get flushed when I did that. So I held his hand to reassure him. And in a way, I kind of established a doctor-patient relationship with him. He's a nice old man, but very, very ignorant. He would have been a good chicken farmer, for instance.
Or a horse rancher.
Or a horse rancher. He loved that. But totally inappropriate to be president. I assessed his IQ clinically to be about 100. And then I came out and I said, I think that he has impending Alzheimer's, which in fact was the correct diagnosis.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're in the hands of fallible men. And these scientists from Oppenheimer and Teller and everyone, and the politicians and the military men, have set up the world ready to be decimated with the press of the button by a fallible human being, or by accident, or by hackers, or by design, or God knows what. And we go ahead completely ignoring it, practicing what you could call manic denial or displacement activity, and not constant. You know, in a way, we're practicing passive suicide. Well, it's not in a way, we actually are. And Australia, who has got no guts at the moment, is not standing up to, I mean, we're the 51st state of the US, unless you are. Maybe you're the 52nd.
And
we once were very powerful, very independent, and stood up to the US like New Zealand did when she prevented nuclear ships coming into her harbors.
Yeah, and they paid a price for that. But
they didn't pay a price. They didn't.
Well, Maybe Pierre Trudeau was maybe as far along as we ever got on that road, and that this new Trudeau is no Pierre Trudeau. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking with Dr. Helen Caldicott, and Helen is a physician, author, and lecturer. She's for more than 30 years studied, written, and campaigned against the proliferation of nuclear weapons and their derivatives. Her book titles include If You Love This Planet, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer, The New Nuclear Danger, Depleted Uranium Medal of Dishonor, and If You Love This Planet, A Plan to Heal the Earth, and her latest is impending. It's Sleepwalking to Armageddon, which you didn't write, right, Helen? It's you were served as the editor on this, right?
Yes. Well, I held a symposium 2 years ago at the New York Academy of Medicine titled "The Threat of Impending Nuclear War," and I invited people like Chomsky and the best physicists and engineers and thinkers in the world, really, for 2 days to discuss this. And so the book that's coming out is the proceedings from that symposium, and it could not be more timely.
Well, yeah, you're not kidding. You know, Helen, it was my previous guest, Dar Jamal, he spoke about climate denial, and you mentioned this manic denial. Yeah, I know in Canada, there's a sort of a necessary denial of the nuclear arm race, denying the fact that Canada stood right between Russia and America, these two belligerents, and we would likely be the first ones to be sacrificed if ever a war broke out. The sense that we're denying the fate of nuclear war right now is striking to me. It seems that somehow in America they've convinced themselves that Russia is weak and doesn't have these weapons anymore. It's the only thing I can think of, you know?
Huge, huge hydrogen bombs, much bigger than Americans because they're less accurate. But of the 16,400 hydrogen bombs in the world today, Russia and America own 94%. The real terrorists in the world are not ISIS. They are Russia and America, who are threatening at any point in time to destroy maybe the only life in the universe. If that's not terrorism, I don't know what is.
No, Helen, when I mentioned derivatives of nuclear, I'm thinking, you know, it was just revealed last week that the Americans admitted that they've been using in Syria, as well as other places, of course, depleted uranium munitions. You write about it, of course, in your book, Depleted Uranium Medal of Dishonor. Can you elucidate, in the diminishing time we have left, what DU is and what threats it poses, irrespective of nuclear weapons?
Depleted uranium is uranium-238, which is left after they get uranium-235 out for their nuclear weapons and nuclear power. It's 1.7 times more dense than lead. And therefore, momentum by mass, velocity by mass equals momentum. It has a much greater momentum than lead. So it's used in anti-tank shells and lots of other sort of munitions. It is pyrophoric in that when it hits the tank, about 80% of it burns in a very white-hot heat, producing tiny aerosolized particles, which are spread throughout the air, in the water, get into the food and the milk and the like. Now, it's extremely carcinogenic. It emits an alpha particle, which, if you look it up, is very mutagenic and carcinogenic. And when they use it in Basra and Fallujah, mm-hmm. The incidence of very, very severe congenital deformities, like babies who are born with no brains, anencephaly, or babies born with no arms, or jelly-type babies, or whatever, is so high that the doctors have told the women to stop having babies. The incidence of childhood cancer has gone through the roof, and the doctors just stand at the foot of patients' beds weeping because they don't have the drugs they need to treat the children. The half-life of uranium-238 is 4.5 billion years. So in truth, America has been conducting a nuclear war in Iraq, in Syria, and Afghanistan. They used it, I think, in Bosnia at the time. It's just obscene, and I wrote an article about this for the New York Times years ago, and they said we are unable to publish this They didn't say why, but I suppose they were told by the Pentagon they could not. If you read the Pentagon's literature, all the problems with uranium-238 are elucidated in the literature, and in fact, in my book, I think, The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's Military-Industrial Complex, there are several chapters on depleted uranium weapons.
Well, Helen, and of course, your latest book, your forthcoming book, is in July. You're going to release
July.
Sleepwalking to Armageddon. Yes. Helen, it's always fantastic to speak with you, if not frightening and existentially horrifying.
You ought to be frightened.
Well, Helen, please enjoy your time on this side of the Pacific, and
I
look forward to talking to you again and reading the book when it comes out in July.
Thank you, Chris, and my high regards to the Canadians, who I'm very fond of.
Well, I wish we could live up to your expectations, honestly. Thanks a lot, Helen.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye now. And also thanks to Dar Jamal and Janine Bancroft and all the people up here that keep the wheels spinning week in and week out. Go to Helen's site, helencaldicott.com. You can find out more about what she's doing and her radio work and films and books, etc., speaking engagements. But this is all I've got. Stick around, though. You know that we've got great programming here. This is the Voice of Victoria, and coming straight up on that voice will be, or the next voice you'll hear will be Linda's Garden City Jukebox. Jeez, I almost lost it there. That's all I've got.